Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of things to talk about. Wanda, thanks for holding on over the break. We're going to talk a little bit more this morning about some of the misperceptions about the Christmas part of our holidays. The crazy idea, and boy, I've gotten into some. There are people who want to believe, like they want to believe in Santa Claus. Of course, we all do. But they want to believe that poinsettias are poisonous. But you could believe in Santa Claus, but if you believe poinsettias are poisonous, you really don't know what you're doing. They're not at all toxic or poisonous. One of the things I used to do with when I was on the show with John Nodar is every year we would eat poinsettias on the air and then wait to die. We couldn't wait too long because it was a short show. But the fact of the matter is the next week we came back and we were still alive. Mistletoe, another great thing. Just a crazy thing about mistletoe being toxic. It's not. We'll come back. We'll talk about that. But first, Wanda, thanks for holding on.
Sure. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
I have a question. We're building a new home in Stapleton, Alabama, and I've got about 250 feet that I want to plant a fence row down that will block my view. It's beautiful over there, and I just don't want to see what's beyond my property. So I'd like to plant a fence row, and I don't really know what to plant.
You know, there's lots of options, and it depends on what you're trying to hide and how far away the fence row is from your house and how tall you need those plants to be. I will tell you one thing. When you plant a wall, it almost makes you want to see what's on the other side of that wall. It almost directs your eye to it. And it makes you want to look over, particularly when everything is the same height. I always recommend when you're planning a screen, don't make it look like a screen. Make it a feature in and of itself. Use multiple plant heights. And so if I were going to use a screen, for example, I might, and I don't know what you're blocking out. You might look specifically at the views to see what you're trying to block out, but if you could use magnolias. You could use a grouping of three magnolias. And then next to it, use something a little smaller, like camellias or something else. So camellias make great hedges, and really, particularly some of the taller growing ones, and they can grow pretty fast. So the other issue that we have, that's one of the things. But then the other issue is, how do you find something that grows fast enough to make the screen right away? And here's the problem: if you find something that grows too fast, it's going to grow too fast to prune. So after a while, it just becomes a nightmare, and then you start losing lower branches and lots of other things. So when you talk about planting screens, you didn't ask all these questions, but I'm telling you anyway. When you make a screen, this is helpful to think about. Plant a temporary screen first. What we call kind of a nurse crop or an intermediate crop. So you could come by and you could plant something like loblolly pines because you know they're going to grow fast, or shortleaf or slash pines because you know they're going to grow pretty fast. They're going to make a screen very fast. The trouble is at about somewhere between 5 and 10 years, they're going to get too big to prune easily, and they're going to start developing gaps, and you're not really going to be able to deal with them. So what I suggest is plant that as an initial screen, and then right behind it, or right in front of it, however you want to look at it, but probably right behind it, plant the screen that you ultimately want so you can give it time to grow. So on that second screen, you can plant, you know, in the screen that you want to be permanent, you plant your magnolias, you plant your camellias, you can, that way you can use a whole different suite of plants that become easier to manage over time because you've got that other screen right in front of it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Where we're going to plant this at is we've got 3 acres, and so it's, we've got a lot of space there, and it's a good ways away from the house, so it's not something up real close. What I want to block is there's the neighbors right behind us built pretty close to the property line there, and they've got boats and kids' stuff, and, you know, I just want it more natural looking. Not that like the neighbors, I just want something more natural looking.
So here's a couple of ways of thinking about it. Again, you don't necessarily have to plant the whole fence line. Take a look across your neighbor's yard and find the parts of the yard that you find least attractive, where the boats are, where the house is, where the kids' playthings are, and screen that. But if there are other views that you can direct people to across their yard that are much prettier, allow those places to stay open. Does that make sense? And that way...
Yeah.
In fact, it's much more effective if you can do it that way. Now, for taller plants, here's one of the if you can find it, one of the great there are a couple of tall plants that work very well. Magnolias grow extremely fast, we forget this, but they can grow very fast. The trouble is, you want to find a magnolia that has limbs all the way to the ground, and you never want to prune those limbs. If you do that, you're going to have a great magnolia that makes a great screen. If you start pruning the lower limbs, obviously you've lost it. Plant those magnolias pretty far apart. Don't plant little gems or anything like that. They're not what you want. You want a good old magnolia. You want the limbs to drop to the ground. And you want the magnolias ultimately to be about, I'd say about 15 feet apart at least. And so initially... maybe even 20 feet apart. Initially, maybe what you want to do is to plant a magnolia alternated with a loblolly pine, and then take those pines out as the magnolias begin to grow and get some size. You don't want the pines to shade out the magnolias because you want those limbs to be on the ground. Another great plant for that area is spruce pine, if you can find it. Our native spruce pine, Pinus glabra, G-L-A-B-R-A, is a great plant. A lot of times the botanical gardens has those. It holds its limbs close to the ground. It will hold limbs close to the ground and make a Christmas tree shape for many years. Great pine, beautiful pine. Another, and it holds up to hurricanes really well. So do magnolias. Cryptomerias, Japanese cedars, are another really great tall thing that basically you can plant them all in the same way you would plant the magnolia. And so there's three. If I told you more, you'd get bored and forget them all. But those are three really good ones.
Is there a shrub type of a plant that would grow up about 6 foot tall that would be a good block wall that I could fill in with?
Sure. There's nothing easier and better than and easier to find than azaleas. You find a good old Southern Indian azalea, particularly the mean old, good old mean old Formosa, which is the big purple, and that thing will be 8 feet tall in no time if you treat it with any kind of care, and it makes it as a shrub. It's really hard to beat in terms of getting up to size very quickly. It's very easy to find and not that expensive. So that's a great thing for about a 6 to 8 foot high shrub would be great. Formosa would be great.
Okay.
And,
thank you.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Wanda. I hope some of that helps. How do you make those screens? Don't think about using just one plant. It always creates a problem when you do that because it sort of makes you.
I'm sorry for what you say.
It sort of makes you look at as a wall, and everybody wants to see around a wall. You don't want a wall. You want a background. You know, you want a nice background with many different shapes, many different sizes, many different textures. Make it interesting. Use three different textures, three different sizes in your screen, and it will be far more effective. There you go. Hey, do we have any other callers there, Charlie?
No.
Okay.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
The rain is falling through the mist of sorrow that surrounded me.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Charlie, have we got any callers on the line? Okay, so listen, let's get back to this poison plant thing, which is kind of a funny thing. I'm not sure how the trend got started, but it's been going on for a number of years, people trying to find problems with Christmas decorations. You know, I think it is the fact that Christmas is the time when we bring plants inside the house. And there are people who believe we should be living in spacesuits. And I oppose the concept of living in spacesuits. it's, you know, whether we want to seal our houses up so tight that we can't breathe anymore, living in the formaldehyde of our houses, which is, it's just crazy to me. And so, of all the things to worry about in your house at Christmas, the thing that you probably should worry about least, the thing you should worry about the least, are the plants that you bring inside. Poinsettia is not poisonous at all. You know, I it's hard to figure out how that whole thing got started. You know, somebody said something, and then some TV news person, I'm sorry, I have to blame it on the TV, but the TV is very effective at spreading bad stuff. Excuse me, and almost as effective as Facebook. It's spreading bad rumors. And so the TV person comes on, and he or she or it needs a report at Christmas, okay, that catches people's attention. So what are they going to say? Oh, you're going to die from poinsettias. Well, you're not going to die from poinsettias. It's the craziest thing in the world. I mean, they're perfectly non-toxic. They don't taste good. They don't particularly taste good. Nobody's going to eat enough to, even if they were toxic, nobody's going to eat enough because they don't really taste all that good. I mean, I can tell you because I've eaten them many times. And I ate them simply to demonstrate that they're not at all toxic. Mistletoe's another one of those things, and I don't know how the mistletoe thing got started. It may be that the European mistletoe, the European species of mistletoe, is a little more toxic than the American species. But if you have American mistletoe, there's no way you're going to eat enough for it to cause problems, berries or otherwise. Birds eat it all the time. That's how it's spread. It's not toxic. The berries are not toxic. The leaves are not particularly toxic at all. I mean, I guess you could get a stomach upset from eating the leaves, but you'd get a stomach upset from eating oak leaves. It's not, you know, your stomach just can't digest it very well. So, of course, it doesn't like it, but it's not toxic. The mistletoe is not toxic. Holly berries, you know, this comes up nearly every Christmas. Somebody's worried about, oh, my dog's going to die from holly berries. Your dog's not going to die from holly berries. Your dog's going to die because you're feeding it too much. He's overweight. He can't move around. That's what your dog's going to die from. He's not going to die from eating holly berries. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But there it is. It's this false idea that these decorations that we bring inside are going to harm us. I don't know why we have that feeling. I guess because we've created our houses as this isolated space that completely isolated from the world around us. It's our spacesuit. And suddenly at Christmas we say, okay, the spacesuit's done. We're bringing the outside in. We're going to have these wonderful plants. And then everybody feels like, oh, the spacesuit's been violated. Well, yes, it's been violated. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Those aromas, those smells of the outside, we bring them inside. Those textures, those feels of the outside, we bring them inside at Christmas. It's really the fun part of Christmas, is bringing all those weird plants inside for the first time, having a great time with them, enjoying them. So don't worry about the poisonous effects of the plants of the season. There are no poisonous effects. None that you need to worry about at all. There it is. So what are some of the other great plants we can bring inside? We've been thinking about it. I got to say, because we haven't talked about it, and Taxman, I'm wondering if anyone has tried this. One of the great odors of the season, and I think they ought to be blooming this week, because the weather's just about right for it. The temperature's right. They've been blooming a lot this year. The rains have come in. Is tea olive. Tea olive is one of these old shrubs that we see around the southern gardens. They've been here for a long time. Some people call them sweet olive. Some people call them tea olive. There's no official common name. You can call them whatever you like, whatever you're most comfortable with, as long as everybody else knows what you mean. But they're the plants with that beautiful, wonderful, sweet fragrance this time of year that you smell so much in South Alabama. As you move into North Alabama, you see it less, I think, because they have fewer days when it blooms, and it's not because the temperatures are a little colder up north. But down in South Alabama, South Mississippi, Florida Panhandle, sweet olive is a part of every old garden, and it is one of the most beautiful, beautiful fragrances in the world. What happens if you bring that inside? I haven't done that. I mean to do that this year. If anybody's done it, I'd like to try that this year, and I'd like to hear what you're thinking. We got some callers. I'm listening. Who's up, Charlie?
Tom is up.
Tom is up. Tom, what's up?
Oh, I ain't much to it. A couple of questions I want to ask you. I planted some turnips about a month ago, and they got up about 3 to 5 inches. I figured, well, I had a few something eating them. So my daughter, she says, well, Daddy, spray some Dawn dishwashing liquid and some water on them. Ooh, not a good idea. Burn them up.
I tell people this all the time, and it does, and there are a lot of people who do it. There is Dawn is a detergent, and what detergents do is they break down the surface of things, and that means they break down the coating on leaves, and they can do real damage to leaves. So it's a terrible thing to do, and I've seen lots of people doing it. It may or may not have an effect on the worms, but here's the very simple thing. Can I tell you what to do? If caterpillars are eating your leaves, you buy a very simple product. It's very easy. It's non-toxic. It's very safe. It's very, very safe. It will be sold under the name Dipel, D-I-P-E-L, or under the name Thuricide, T-H-U-R-I-C-I-D-E. It's actually a disease that affects only caterpillars. It's a cool thing. It's a caterpillar disease. It doesn't affect people at all, doesn't affect other things, but it affects the caterpillars if caterpillars are what are eating your turnips this time of year. See, but it could be caterpillars. The other things that can eat turnips this time of year are a little harder to control, and that would be flea beetles. It is not easy to control flea beetles. There's no question. It can be very hard. You're probably if that's what you have. Are the holes very tiny?
Yeah. It looks like you shot them with birdshot.
Yeah. So that's right. So it's probably a flea beetle. Flea beetles are harder to control. Sometimes if you want to use something non-toxic, sometimes ash works okay. Sometimes pepper spray can work. That can help as well. So all of those things, garlic spray, but once those flea beetles get started, it can be pretty hard to control. One suggestion on eating plants, eating turnips that have flea beetle damage. The first thing I suggest is don't eat the holes. You okay with that? Don't eat the holes. Don't eat the holes. So here's how you not eat the holes. You can't eat the holes. And so the damage that they do is not really going to show up once you cook those turnips. They're going to be just fine. The leaves are going to taste just as good. So don't feel bad about having a few holes in there. If the holes are pretty bad, if you're getting a lot of them, then you might need to use something else. I guess probably if I were going to choose, if I were going to use a poison, I to get flea beetles, it would probably be seven dust. It helps a little bit. I worry about seven dust because it's a carbamate pesticide. It is toxic. I wouldn't eat the turnips for 2 or 3 days at least after I put the seven dust on there. One of the good things about seven dust is that it doesn't last a long time in the environment, but it is pretty toxic. So be really careful about it. That can control flea beetles. But try the ash first. Sounds like you do have flea beetles. Don't use Dawn dishwashing detergent. It won't control the flea beetles. It will have zero effect on the flea beetles, and it will destroy your plants. I tell people this all the time, and yet lots of people, I don't know, it's Facebook and the internet. Everybody's got a solution that's not really a good solution. So there it is. Does that help?
Yes, sir, it does. Is it too late to replant?
No. In fact, this is probably a good time to replant. You can make several succession plantings of collards. As the weather gets colder, you'll have fewer problems with flea beetles. The turnips will grow slower, but starting the first of the year, you're going to find that turnips and lots of things grow really fast as long as it doesn't get too cold. All right, we're going to come back. I know we've got some callers waiting. We'll be back, and we'll catch those calls as soon as we come back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Go, Bill. Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. I know we've got several callers. We're going to try to get to those callers. You know, I wish... We're gonna figure out what to do about flea beetles. They have become a little bit bigger problem. They are a real serious problem on turnips, no question, and less of a problem on thicker leafed plants. But they can be a real problem on turnips. And I'll do a little bit of research, see if there's anything that's come along that's a little better for flea beetles. I'm seeing it more and more. Charlie, who's our first caller for this segment?
We have Chris on the line.
Chris, I'm listening. What's up?
In reference to propagating japonica, I've got three 30-year-old bushes, and my wife brought up the issue that why the heck are they blooming now? But I've got a bunch of seed pods on these japonicas that over the years I've tried pulling some of the berries off and stuffing them into, like, peat moss balls to try and get them to propagate, and I've been unsuccessful. I tend to want a mildew and mold. Should I use the net type process that you described earlier about collecting seeds, or any suggestions on propagating japonica?
Well, no, they shouldn't be that hard to propagate. So here's the first off, a japonica. What you're referring to as japonica is I'm taking to mean a camellia japonica, which is a group of camellias, the most familiar group of camellias with the large glossy leaves. And they bloom in midwinter. It's the typical time they bloom. They bloom in midwinter because, well, because in Japan where they came from, they're pollinated by birds that and they have to be pollinated long distances. So they wanted these birds to carry the pollen over long distances. So they bloomed in winter so insects wouldn't pollinate them. Curious thing. But here's the thing with occasionally you'll get seeds on japonicas. Camellias, and those seeds are usually easy to get to set with a couple of thoughts. Sometimes the seeds are sterile. Sometimes the seeds aren't for a couple of crazy reasons. The seeds may not be really good at germinating. They may not be viable seeds. We're just going to put it that way. Most of the time they are viable. But when you know that the capsule that the seed comes in actually usually has more than one seed, right? Have you opened the capsule and you see those three seeds inside of it?
No, it's
are you there.
We're talking about two different things.
Okay.
I'm about ready to send you a picture in a moment. And it has nothing to do with camellias. This is a perennial thing. I've got 30. Three of them that have been around for 30 years. They stay green all year long. They have kind of like a fig leaf pattern and just an interesting texture. And I've enjoyed the look of them. So I'll send you some pictures and get some ideas from you. Okay?
Yeah, right, I have no idea what a japonica is.
That are clustered all over these.
Okay, that's an odd name. It's usually japonica refers to the species, not to a genus. So it would be like, it would be like telling me red without telling me that you were talking about an oak.
A picture is worth a thousand words, right?
Let me look at that picture and I'll see what I can do. Good.
Thank you.
All right. Good.
Bruce.
Bruce, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
First of all, thank you for making me somewhat of a decent gardener at some times. Help me for understanding the basics of garden, the soil structures and water and oxygen and sunshine components. But I went out today and my broccoli's starting to snap off at the stems and fall over. It's looking bad. I sent you a picture or two.
Yeah, I saw that. That's really sad, isn't it? All of your plants doing this?
It looks like they're all going to. It's only about three of them out of a dozen now.
And they all have some kind of infection at the base like this?
No, about three of them of the 12 do.
Oh, three. So I'm going to assume that what there's some kind of damage there, probably from a worm.
Yeah, I popped stem in half, I expected to see a grub. I saw, some tunnel-like and hollows, but I did not see any grub in it.
Yeah, so it's probably some type of worm. Okay. And it's a cutworm, quite possibly. That would be the kind of thing that a cutworm would do. And they can be in soil sometime. It's hard to deal with cutworms because they crawl up, they do their work at night, and then they crawl back underground during the day. And so it can be hard to find them and hard to control them because they go back underground. One of the best solution I ever had for cutworms, by the way, was chickens. I'll just say it's really easy. You just turn your chickens into a bed that you're fixing to plant, and they dig it up and they eat every cutworm they can find. And boy, it's really effective. But if you don't have chickens, that's just one of those things. I would take this is a case where I do think there are two ways you can control cutworms. You can take a little cardboard collar. You can make it out of if you make those little cardboard collars they sometimes put in shirts when you sell them, or the little plastic collars that they put in shirts and the collars of your shirt, they make perfect little collars. You can actually put a little collar like that around your plant, and it keeps the cutworm who goes in and out of the ground. The likelihood is the cutworm won't come in he won't cross that barrier when he emerges from the soil. You see what I'm saying? Put it right around the plant, and he won't get to the plant that way. That's what a lot of people do. It can be very effective. The other thing is I think ashes can be very effective because caterpillars don't like those ashes, particularly when they get wet and slimy. You have to reapply them, but ashes around the base of the plant, the caterpillars just don't like going through them, and that's another great way to control cutworms. At this point, the cutworm damage is already done, but I would, and probably the stems are strong enough at this point to resist any more damage from the cutworm, but I might put collars around the rest of my plants just to be sure. I mean, think of different ways to make collars. There's, you know, a little piece of cardboard, a little piece of plastic that just sits right next to the stem. Give the stem just enough room to grow. Kind of insert it in the ground just a little bit, and that will keep those cutworms from getting to it. Does that help, Bruce?
Yeah, I can do that.
And I'm pretty sure that's the issue. I'm just pretty sure that's the issue.
Okay.
I'm so sure that's the issue. I can't think of another thing that it would be that would have caused the same problem.
I might be able to borrow my neighbor's chicken and throw them in there.
Yeah, the problem with putting your chickens in at this stage is they're going to love the broccoli as much as they love the okay. worms. So you got to do that before you plant, and there's a whole process for using chickens in the garden. We'll have to talk about that sometime. So someday, holler at me and we'll talk a little bit more about how to use those chickens to control pests.
Okay.
All right. Hey, Bruce, good to hear from you. Thank you. Charlie, we got another caller?
No.
Okay, good. So I've gotten several messages. I can't tell whether this was our caller earlier who was asking about Japonica. But there is I do have a picture of a Fatsia, which is one of my favorite plants this time of year. It's a shrub, Fatsia, and it is beautiful. It has these beautiful white blooms in bells. I don't really know why Fatsia hasn't caught on. Why Fatsia hasn't caught on better. It's a cool plant, Fatsia, and it is another Japonica, so maybe this was my earlier caller, Chris. Chris, was that you? Fatsia Japonica. Fatsia, Fatsia, it's Aurelia. It's a member of the ginseng family, if I'm not mistaken. That's right. It's a ginseng relative. Really cool, beautiful plant. Beautiful flowers in winter. Just stunning. If you go to our Flickr page, you can actually see this picture and begin to see it. And it does have beautiful fig-like leaves, doesn't it? It's sort of fig-like, palmate, and beautiful white flowers. Fatsia japonica. It'll get pretty tall as time goes on. It can get to be about 6-7 feet tall. Really nice shrub. So what do we do with Fatsia? That's an easy one to remember, Fatsia. What do we do with propagating it? I don't know. I've never propagated it from seeds. I suspect that there may be problems propagating from seeds, particularly if those seeds aren't cross-pollinated. I'll have to check on this. I don't know of anyone who's actually propagating from seeds. Most propagate this plant. Chris, I'm listening. So this is your picture, right, Chris? A Fatsia?
Yeah, this is mine.
Yeah, so it's Fatsia. Fatsia, good.
Okay.
And it doesn't really have another name other than Fatsia, but because Fatsia is kind of a cool name, isn't it? So
it is.
Fatsia,
it's really a cool plant because it stays green all year long. It has the interesting kind of leaves and everything else. It blooms at an odd time of the year. And over the last several years, I've attempted to propagate them using the seeds. The seeds come up like a big purple bunch, almost like a pulque type plant. And they tend to mildew every time I try and propagate them. So I've been trying.
1 minute.
You know, I'll have to research that. There is, it's like ginseng seed. First off, we've got to make sure that the seeds have cross-pollinated effectively and that they're viable. And I'm going to have to check on that. Most
of the I've got like three different plants.
Huh? Yes, but here's the interesting problem. Plants, we do this thing called cloning. And cloning means that every plant is identical to the other plant. So there's no cross-pollination. Does that make any sense? No, it's hard to understand because
yes,
you're a person.
They're brother and sister.
Yeah, it's not just brother and sister. It's the same thing. It's as if, well, it's as if you propagated with yourself, which is a bad thing. It ain't going to happen. So there's no cross-pollination because most of those plants are cloned, even though there's two different plants. I'm going to have to look this up. I have to do a little more research on getting that to propagate by seed. We'll see how that works.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
We only have a few more minutes before the end of our show, and I want to get to a lot of good questions. Aubie asked me, he's got a sucker coming up from his fig, and should he remove it? No. In fact, Aubie, those suckers are better than the original. What you want with a fig is a lot of small suckers. Those are the ones that are easiest to pick. And what you want to do is each year you want to cut out that biggest, fattest stem. So leave the suckers. Always leave the smallest stems that come up that are 2 years old. They're going to be your best producers. The two-year-old stems are your best producers because they're the ones that you can pick easily. And so, no, you don't want to remove suckers when they come up from your figs. Other plants, different story, but figs and things like somebody was going to ask me about how to prune a gardenia. Same with a gardenia. The suckers are better than the main stems. We'll talk about that later, a little bit more next week. I got two callers. Richard, I'm listening. What's up? Is it Richard? Hello. All right.
Yes, she's gone.
Okay. Have we got another caller?
No.
All right. Well, so it's a good thing to go back to the figs. And because somebody was asking earlier about gardenias and pruning gardenias and figs. What with a lot of plants that tend to sucker a lot, particularly if they're flowers and fruiters, the best way to trim them is to trim out the oldest, fattest stems each year. So with gardenias, that's what I recommend. I also recommend that with hydrangeas, is each year prune out 1 to 3 of the fattest stems and let the youngest stems come on. When you do that, you actually preserve the most vigorous stems, right? They're going to be more vigorous. They're younger. They're more vigorous. But you also control the height, which is a very nice thing to do. So that means that if your gardenia is too tall, rather than trying to cut it back with a head shear, like a crew cut, what you're going is you're going down to the base of the plant. You're going to cut that plant at the bottom, and you're going to remove 2 or 3 of the fattest stems at the bottom. Those will also be the tallest stems, so you're going to reduce your height. And by doing that, you don't get rid of your blooms. You keep your plant in good shape. You actually open it up so that it actually breathes a little better. You get a little better air circulation around the base. So all those things work really well. Figs, classic situation too. You don't want a fig tree. You want a fig bush. You want a fig bush, because if it becomes a tree, the birds are going to get all your figs. It's just that simple. And trees are actually a little less productive than bushes in terms of total fig production, too, for a lot of reasons. So what you want to do is you want to prune out those heavy stems each year. Gardenias, figs, hydrangeas, classic case, Philadelphus. You don't know what Philadelphus is. What do we call Philadelphus? Mock orange, English dogwood. Those types of plants need to be pruned back each year. We're pruning back to allow those younger stems to come on. You know, the same thing happens with azaleas. Pretty much the same thing happens with azaleas. You want to, if the stems get too old, too thick, you want to prune out some of those heavy stems after a while. It's a little more complicated with azaleas because they don't sucker quite as readily, but we're sort of trying to do the same thing there too. Boy, we had a great time this morning talking about different things. It was a lot of fun thinking about how do we go into the yard and sort of find our Christmas there rather than having it shipped into us from China in a box. Richard, okay, good. I'm listening. Richard, let's try this real quick before we lose time. What's up?
Hey, I got some blood orange trees. It's about 4 years old, and they're still not producing any fruit. I talked to you about this last year. When I bought them in Belle Chasse, Louisiana, they had blooms on them, and I put them in the back of the truck to come to Orange Beach with them and blew the blooms off, and I've never had blooms since. Thank you.
Yes. So it's the reason you don't have any blooms, you didn't have blooms this past winter, is because it was too cold. And blood oranges are delicate plants. I keep mine in a container. If I were at Orange Beach, I might feel like I could put it outside in a very protected place, but a blood orange is not a Satsuma. It's not as hardy. The buds are going to be very sensitive to cold. A lot of people this year lost the blooms on their blood orange because the past winter was too cold. I don't know what this winter is going to do. It may freeze those buds off again, or you may have it. But your blood orange is in the ground, right?
No, sir. They're in a box. They're in a 2-foot by 2-foot by 2-foot deep box.
Yeah, but are they outside?
Yes, sir. I am the south side of my house.
Yeah, and so they're going to be very susceptible to cold because they're in the box. And being on the south side of the house will help and certainly protect them from the wind. Here's what I would recommend. Do this. So, and this may work for you. If you can tip that, can you tip that box over?
Yes.
On its side?
Yes, sir.
So when you get temperatures that are coming below 32 degrees, take the box, tip it over on its side, and then cover it with a blanket. The whole thing. The box, the branches. That's what I do with my plants. They're in containers. And I just tip them over. I tip the whole container over. It's in a bigger than a 2x2 box. It's a big container. But I just tip the whole thing over on the ground. I take a tarp or a blanket or something and lay over the whole plant. And use the ground heat to protect it. Two blankets if it gets down below 25. Just really, and do that on just those nights, and you'll protect it. It should do fine. I can almost guarantee you you're going to have some fruits, some flowers and fruits the coming year.
All right, buddy. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, good. Good. Vanna, boy, we got just a little bit of time. I'm listening. What's up?
Could you name exactly the type of magnolia that you were describing that grows tall and has the limbs all the way to the ground that act as a good barrier?
Yes, I'm going to say regular old magnolia. Does that work?
Can you buy that in a nursery?
Regular old magnolia. If you get a cultivar like Little Jim, which is a little teeny tiny magnolia, you don't want that. What you want is the regular old evergreen magnolia. There are a bunch of beautiful varieties. Bracken's Brown Beauty is one. But even if they don't have that, as long as it's a regular specimen magnolia, not a Little Jim, not one of these fancy new ones that are dwarf, p- panda or whatever they call that thing, teddy bear. Not that kind of stuff. You want the old big ones. So just tell them, go into the nursery and say, I want a big one. I don't want your baby bears. I don't want your teddy bears. I don't want none of that nonsense. I want a good old, plain old evergreen magnolia. And there you go.
Okay. Thank
All right.
you so much.
Hey, Vanna, call me back. We'll talk more about this. We can have a lot of fun talking about it. Charlie tells me I got to go. That means we're going to have a Merry Christmas, and we're going to see you back next week just before the New Year's holidays. And the days are going to be getting longer, and the things in your garden are going to start growing fast. This is the transition. This is the transition week. You're over the hump. Days are getting longer. Things are going to grow fast. We'll see you then.